ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
ABC Cricket Podcast time with your boys, Corbin Middlemass and Ed Cowan, for your Monday at the completion of the second test. Australia 2-0 up, all the fallout about, weak men and who survives in Australia and whether teams have overprepared. We got it all to chop up, and of course, the Jofra Archer, Steve Smith duel. There's a lot of juicy topics to sink our teeth into. My name's Corbin Middlemass. I'm only minutes back in beautiful Melbourne. We're back in what the Australian cricket team would deem their home ports, and Ed Cowan is back in his in beautiful Sydney. Hello, Teddy.
Corb, it's fair to say, logistically, this could be the trickiest podcast we've ever recorded in 6.5 years. Flights, you name it, delays, but here we are for the listeners. We've made this work. Yes. Late on a Monday.
We both had flights today from various parts of Queensland to make it back to where we're currently chatting. But the good thing is, Steady, we've got cricket on our mind, so we got it's plenty for us to chat about and to debrief out of the second test, where Australia obviously found themselves 2-0 up. Had the Victorian boys obviously on my flight, so the coaches and the players making their way back to Melbourne.
Did they look a little bit hungover?
They were looking pretty fresh. Great. Yeah, still pretty fresh. So you'd be pretty happy, wouldn't you? 2-0 up. No reason not to feel good about the world.
Very, very comfortable. That flight would have been as smooth as it possibly could have been for that group of players and coaching.
I said last night that we got to talk about England, because it feels like that the Bazballers are getting fitted up big time. Nasser Hussain sort of led the charge on out-batted, out-bowled, out-fielded, out-thought. There are all kinds of criticisms that are obviously coming their way with good reason. Where do you start, Teddy, when you look take a zoomed out lens on where the Bazballers are at now, what, 24 hours removed from the second test?
Yeah, I mean, the temptation is, and this is where my thoughts immediately go watching them play cricket, by the way, so I'm just going to start here and I'll probably take a step back as we go. But the comments of Ben Stokes come to mind. Don't call us arrogant. Call us crap or something, he said after the first test.
Don't call us arrogant.
But it's hard not to gravitate to that word. So if you look at the definition of arrogance, it's like the quality of having an exaggerated sense of one's own abilities. Doesn't that just instantly ring of what this England team is providing? Because let's just put the team maybe to one side. How would that play out? If you were arrogant about your cricket, how would it play out? Would it mean that you don't really take many tour games on? Would it mean that you choose not to play extra games? Does it turn into ignoring data and history as to what might win? If you had an exaggerated sense of your own ability, do you not think all those things would apply? Because I'm finding it hard to reconcile his view of the world and what we see. And we constantly see, because they're off in Noosa having a reset rather than getting to Adelaide, getting in the nets, getting their heads down. The concept that they over-prepared, I find that very hard to believe. There were some absolute dollies dropped this test match. Guess what? Catching is a volume game. Catching under lights is a volume game. Catching with a pink ball under lights, even more so. So all the little, what cricketers call one percenters, they are things that add up, and they're all the things that have been ignored. And so that's how I start, just so I'm setting a baseline. But then I think, actually, if we go back even further a step, maybe they're just not very good. And this is the only way that they can get the most out of themselves, is actually cocoon themselves in this crazy, overconfidence, arrogant cocoon. And that kind of washes away the fact that they can't bowl the same ball four balls in a row, that they can't bat for more than 30 balls. I don't know. So I'm kind of now, that's kind of washed over me, the arrogant, easy stab, but it's now actually, this is just a team in total structural decline. They have some skill, but not really. They have some character, but not really. And so they're trying to get the best out of a pretty average group of cricketers. I don't know if you have a view. It's like, it feels like I kind of laid everything on the table.
It's a perfect start. To be honest, the bit you got to at the end was the same thing I was thinking about on my 2.5 hour flight from Brisbane to Melbourne, where I was watching all the wrap up shows, and everyone's had a go at obviously talking about where they're at really over the last 2 days. It felt like it started at the end of day three and obviously continued on last night. But from Ben Stokes saying, look, it's definitely not a skill thing, to Stuart Broad saying, they've only played to 20% of their potential so far on this series, and all the optimism that came with England down under, I actually feel like one of the guys that would be the least surprised about where they're at would be Brendan McCullum. And I feel like the whole Bazball philosophy has been, how do we get the most out of these guys? And he's done a great job at being able to do that. But at a certain point, you reach your ceiling. And to win in Australia against an Australian team, and I know there's all this talk, oh, they're not as great as Australian teams of the past and everything else, they're still a pretty good team. And Australia very rarely field bad teams at home. And so for England to win down here, it needs to often dovetail beautifully between a really good England team and an Australian team, obviously, which is on the decline. And so as much as maybe one's been overestimated, which is how much of a decline the Aussies are on, I think the other one has been too. I mean, since Bodyline, and we talked a lot about this throughout the series so far, there's really been like four England teams in 93 years. So this team had to be a once in a 20-year team. And that they've just proven time and time again that they're not really that. Like that they're, I actually think McCullum's done a great job to be able to get what he has out of them. But is Crawley a generational player? Is Ben Duckett? Is Ollie Pope? You can go through the lineup. They've got a couple of guys, but I think they're just an average team that have been able to get the best out of themselves until now. But winning in Australia is different gravy, the same way it is winning in India, and they're learning that the hard way.
Yeah, I think that's a perfect summation of exactly how I feel. That was well articulated. If you look at their team, they have two great cricketers in Root and Stokes. Pope, Crawley, Duckett, Jamie Smith to a lesser degree. They're just middling cricketers. I think Harry Brook has the potential to be a superstar. And then if you look at their fast bowlers, they all have some skill to bowl fast. But the ability we know in Australia is to do it for long periods of time, and they just can't build any pressure. And these are guys, and it plays to the philosophy of let's pick that as the let's optimize for that. And so when it comes to durability, when it comes to the ability to take wickets consistently, be it in county cricket or test cricket, if they can get on the park, it's largely been kind of ignored. It's like we're just going to take a snapshot of what we want, and we're going to isolate it, and we're going to put it over here and assume that that's going to work. So maybe it's a little bit of both in terms of if we kind of segregate how much is arrogance and how much is a lack of skill. And I think it's easy to gravitate to the first. And you're right. It, given the skill set, maybe we'll look back and say McCullum has done a good job, because this team was, if you go back when he took over, 3 years ago, it was pathetic.
1 in 7.
They were a pathetic cricket team. So now they're just a middling one.
Yep. Yeah, I think it was 1 in 17 when he took over, and they've won more than they've lost over the last 3 years, but they haven't beaten India and they haven't beaten Australia, which are the two biggest battles, and clearly for them they're two biggest challenges. I saw Geoffrey Boycott's piece where he quoted the famous Jack Nicklaus quote, where Jack was basically once asked, what's the best club in your bag? And he essentially pointed to his temple and said, my brain, my head.
15th like, club is in the golf bag, the mind.
Yes, yeah. Like this is what it's all about. And you can't help but feel that when you watch this English team, where the ability to kind of think their way through it. And again, to pick up on your arrogance point, it sort of feels to me even more so than that. They're just, and teams often do this, they become a reflection of their leaders. And so I don't even know if it's so much arrogance as much as it is, this is what McCullum did or knows what it takes to be successful. Never really ultimately successful. New Zealand ended up winning their major global title after he'd finished playing. And for Ben Stokes, coming out talking about weak and being strong and everything else and the way that he plays cricket, it felt like that's a reflection of him, and it felt like him talking. And I often wonder about, there's so many different personality types that make up a dressing room, and you think, what about Jamie Smith, for example? So the first time Jamie Smith saw a pink ball in a professional cricket game was when Mitchell Starc's running into bowl to him, or when he's trying to take the catch and spills Travis Head. Basically, that's his introduction to it. And you think, surely, like, as much as that might be the best for McCullum and for Stokes, how to go about it, surely that's not the best for everybody in the dressing room. And Jamie Smith, I felt like, was the guy that almost epitomised that more than anyone else this test match.
Yeah, and we touched on leading into the test when the discussion was on around Canberra. There are two distinct kind of ways these teams go about it. Forget the actual output, and you nailed it. All cultures reflect the leaders of those cultures. And so Stokes, McCullum, or Cummins / Smith and McDonald. And the variation here is one is top-down, McCullum and Stokes. This is how you play. And if you're a player, if you want to keep your place in the team, of course you're going to buy into that. There's only one international team you can play for. This is not an open franchise market. And so you don't get to choose to play for another team. If you want to play test cricket and enjoy that experience for as long as you can, and I look at Ollie Pope actually when I see this, because he's a grafting batter. This baseball thing does not suit him at all, and so he has to actually totally transform how he wants to play. And so, and that's kind of like an isolated example. There are lots of them. You'd point to Jamie Smith, but if you don't behave how they want to behave or play how they want you to play, you're out of the team. And there's this. I think it was Stuart Broad said, either this week or last, there's a tendency in this team to watch someone play cricket and say in 30 seconds he can play or not. So that, not based in, how many hundreds, how long they bat for, do they win games for their team? It's, I can see them bat and I'm going to trust my intuition and my skill to say that's going to fit how we want to play cricket. That is so far out of how it should work.
I wonder what they would have thought of Steve Smith after 30 seconds. Imagine watching him bat for 30 seconds and go and seeing him move around and all jittery and whether he'd fit the system or not.
And so to compare that to the Australians, and as you pointed out, different personalities, different roles in the team, how can we get the most out of these players as individuals and bring them together under a common thread as a team? And this test we talked last night, Michael Nisa was a great case in point, but everyone has their individual styles that they can still gravitate to that has made them successful in professional cricket, made them hardened professional cricketers that then come together as a team to play under a common set of values, really. But there's no common way aside from performance. You go out and perform, you keep your place. If you don't, ideally, you get dropped, or in some cases, depending how many runs in the bank you have, you don't. So it's like they're working at different ends of the spectrum, but it does speak to the not. It's more than philosophical, actually. It's actually deeply cultural.
It's a fascinating watch as to how they get themselves out of it on this tour to begin with, and then more broadly where it goes from here. Given that this was the centerpiece of the project, I think to answer your first point, I feel like I'm leaning more in the just not good enough category more than I am the arrogance as a cricket team.
I am too.
There's a lot to pick apart in all that.
I feel like I'm doing lots of talking, but maybe it's the flights give you too much reflection time.
Yes.
Because there's no way, actually, that the bowlers, and there was a little comment from McCullers, the bowlers actually plan to bowl belly button length for 3 hours. I just don't think they have the ability to execute under pressure consistently what the plans were. And McCullum kind of hinted this, as I said, he goes, we were really disappointed with how we bowled. Well, if they're not the plans and you can't execute on the plans, you've got to change the people, not the plans. And so it's like, where to from here, having formulated a group around it? Because they were so bad with the ball in this test match. So far, they were so far away.
Yeah. And whose spot in the team is under immediate pressure? What, one guy? Are we talking maybe Ollie Pope, maybe one of the bowlers might miss out? And yet that's part of the issue too. And we Ali Mitchell made a good point when we're talking about Michael Nisa on the before the start of play on day four about, you know, Nisa bowled like a guy that could be playing his last Test match. You know, how many guys in the England team do you feel like you're watching play that they're playing as if this is my last Test? And it's and some of that, you know, that tension's good, isn't it, Teddy? That anxiety of feeling like, you know, I got to go and perform. I'm playing for my place in the team. Like,
but it doesn't matter how good a player you are, how long you've played for, that performance anxiety actually brings the best out. If you're not playing with any emotion, or and that emotion might play out as fear or anxiety, you know, that's the edge that you require for extreme high performance. Yes, for mastery, there's a sense of relaxed calm, but it's coupled with a nervousness, a little feeling in your stomach of, is today the day? Some mystery. I'm going to go and actually unravel this for me to prove to myself that I'm good enough. And even going back to, the bowlers and not being able to do that, how best to eradicate that under pressure, deliver consistently? Let's play more cricket, isn't it?
Yeah.
To create the pressured environment so that when the pressure cooker is on, you can have the confidence in yourself. So it's not exaggerated self-confidence. It's actually deep-rooted belief based in fact that you can do it.
So do you have an issue with them going to Noosa? I mean, this is always the balance between, you know, doing more, playing more cricket and the mental freshen up and everything else. Like, where do you sit on that?
When you've got back-to-back Tests in this case, a little short freshen up is helpful. But there's also a decent break between Adelaide and Boxing Day. And so the work needed to be done before this Brisbane Test. And they talk about, we had 5 great training sessions. And it's like, that's what was it, 12 days or something? I'm thinking, you're probably 5 short. You're not over-prepared. Yeah. There's, in no world are you over-prepared.
You can't say that, can you? Like you can say whatever you want as Brendan McCullum. You cannot say surely that they're over-prepared given that they played the way they did.
Look at the faces on the panel when Ponting, Broad, they were like, that sound grab. But you hear McCullum talk. He's very considered and thoughtful. Yep. There's no hubris in what he says.
No.
He just believes this to be the best way to prepare a cricket team, and so be it.
Yeah. But again, that's where, you know, the history of the game will tell you that that's not how you win down here. And we've seen that sort of time and time again, and there's a reason for it. And by the way, Brendan McCullum didn't win down here a whole lot as well. I mean, as great a player as he was, that they didn't have a whole lot of success. And, you know, what worked for him and, may not necessarily, work for the broader group. And this is the push and pull, isn't it, of, getting the most out of them in the way they're going about it, and also, understanding that this might be the best that England can be, but it's not nearly good enough to be an Ashes winning team away from home.
And I'm sure it infuriates the batting coaches. You know, hey, let's go have a couple of surf lessons and work on our tan, because there are some significant technical issues in that top order in these conditions. So maybe they get away with it in England, but without being able to work on those and those technical nuances, it's not a 20-minute, hey, let's have some throwdowns and fix them. The fundamental bat swing of Crawley and Pope and how they're not transferring their weight and their front hips coming out and their bats coming through, almost what you'd describe as kind of brushing the ball, like a little top spin, and it's catching the inside edge. And, those caught and bowled were case in point as the wicket slowed up. But even Crawley in the first innings, he got some runs, but a lot of his shots, he's not holding his shape at all. He's trying to hit the ball through wide mid-off and it goes through mid-on. Like the technical bat swing is so far off where it needs to be in Australia. And so you got to grind that out. Like that's, you were talking about the golf analogy. That's on the range, practicing, drilling down your technique, because you can't get that facing bowlers. If that's hours of grooving away from bowlers. And so if I was Ollie Pope, I'd be saying, can you just get me to Adelaide? I've got 10 days of work to fit into 5 before I'm even ready to start my next preparation that you want to start. So just trust me that I need to grind here. You don't grind away on a longboard out the back of Main Beach in Noosa. That's not where you grind.
Yep. And yet Marcus Trzaskowski sort of the other night had some probably regrettable comments in the media as well, where he was, you know, trying to justify the driving on the ump and the modes of dismissals. And
it actually sounded like he was saying, pulling his hair out, to be honest. I know the words, the words and the vocal intent that you heard, it was almost like I'm saying this, but I don't believe it. And my goodness, am I losing some sleep over some of the ridiculous dismissals.
Yeah. So Ben Stokes said as part of the presentation, we've had some words in the dressing room. We're not going to tell you what they are. What should they be? Teddy, if what do you want to hear from your captain? You're 2-0 down. The matches have unfolded the way they have. Really, there were no redeeming qualities out of the loss in Brisbane. So what should the captain be saying?
It's very hard in a change room that, you know, historically you're not allowed to say anything negative about anything. And so to then flick the switch to, hey, guys, this ain't good enough. Pull your heads in. We've got to actually get back to playing some hard, you know, thoughtful cricket. So, you know, part of that is we need you to reflect. What do you need to get better in this moment? Come to us. We're here to support that. And we just there's no way but up. So there's no point in moping around, kicking the cans. It's about self-reflection and outcomes. And so how do you need to, after that self-reflection, how can you actually prepare to get those outcomes? And so it's then the coach's job to set up the structures for that to happen. And if one of those structures is no training, it actually gets pretty tricky.
Mm-hmm. Did the fight on day 4 raise more questions or deliver some answers?
I think it delivered some answers, don't you think?
I think it raised more questions. We thought, why are they doing that now, where they haven't done that the whole way through? And yeah, why did it take Stokes and Jacks to all of a sudden decide, you know what, we're just going to play properly? And you think, well, how come no one else did that earlier? Why is Jofra Archibald on 150 clicks in the last innings of the match when he wasn't doing that earlier?
He's an absolute cat. That's why.
Like to me, it's more of a head scratcher that you just think, why is this happening now on the last day when really the test is lost? That, oh, we're going to show some fight. And you know, Stokes, I'm not trying to say he's putting it on or anything like that, but you could see the frustration, how much it meant to him. And you thought, well, where does that permeate through the dressing room, whether they're getting out the way they did in the second innings in Perth and the first innings here in Brisbane? And it just felt like an odd time for it to show some resolve and sort of what does it all actually stand for or mean? And maybe we won't get the answer until Adelaide, but it was a weird time to have this come to Jesus moment, and all of a sudden we're going to play properly on day 4 of a loss test.
Well, actually, I think Stokes played properly on the first day. I actually think they batted well and had some runs on the board. So remember, let's go back to day 1. Let's not get caught up in the emotion of the 4-day test. Runs on the board, and we thought, hey, maybe you could declare and have a nibble here, and you know, they got 50 runs. And we thought, oh, maybe they did the right thing, but at that point, for the first 2 innings, we hadn't seen a new ball under lights until really day 3 when it caused some damage. And so they had runs on the board and they should have been 60, 80 more. Like, the Australian attack looked pedestrian. Stokes got run out. So Root and Stokes were batting beautifully. So they were batting properly. So I think it's the others who are still a little convoluted in mind as to how they can actually score some runs down here. And so the game could have had a different complexion. It obviously didn't. But then they dropped everything. And so
bowled badly
and still dropped everything. So it could have been even Stevens after the first innings, and then you work your way in. And once you're 160 ahead, the game's done, 170 ahead. So it was just more of a progression from what I saw in the first innings, actually, from their two best players to actually show some courage and some fight. So I think we'll see more of that, and I think the question is for the others to step up to that level. I mean, that's kind of my read through. I think there'll be changes in the team. I would drop Archer. I'd say, mate, it was actually a pathetic test from him. The way he bowled with the new ball to the carry on at the end, I'm like, that is not what our team stands for. You can move aside and Josh Tung can have a go, and you got to play a spinner. So
does Jack stay in the team, or what are they, does Bashir come in?
He stays in the team as a batter. Bat him at three and play your finger spinner. Why did Bashir play the last 2 years of test cricket if he wasn't going to play in Australia.
Yeah, the only thing I can think of is maybe they thought if we play him here in this pink ball test at the Gabba and Australia target him, they could whack him out of the series. And so basically we'll save him for Adelaide, Melbourne and Sydney where he's going to be a bit more effective. We'll have that chat with him that, hey, these venues aren't going to suit you, but we're gonna launch you in Adelaide, so get ready to go. The time's coming. Yeah. So I can see that, for example, as to if that's the message. Yeah. Because imagine if they take to him in Perth or Brisbane on a pitch that doesn't suit. We've seen that unravel, haven't we, for visiting teams spinners in the past. So what, Pope, have you got Pope in or out?
No, he's lying through your man, unfortunately.
Yeah, but not at the expense of Bethel, at the expense of Jackson, that everyone bumps up.
Correct.
One. Yeah. What about Stokes to three? I saw that floated somewhere as well.
Not when he's doing the bowling he's doing. That's not fair.
And then the Australian side of things. So we talked a little bit about Michael Nisa last night. He's coming off a fifer, and yet he's no guarantee given the fact that Cummins and Lyon have to come back into this lineup. It feels like Doggett will probably miss. Yeah. I think that's probably fair to say.
Yeah, I think that is fair to say.
What happens with Nisa?
Well, I think he misses. But, you know, the joy of how this squad has evolved and how people are willing to play their role. Let's not say he's done for the series, but for the moment, the world's greatest fast bowler is about to come back into the team, and so he'll drop out and the world's best finger spinner comes back into the team, and so Doggett will drop as well.
You gave the selectors a lot of credit last night. Basically said, look, hey, you're accountable for your decisions. And ultimately, they got the 20 wickets. They won the test. Nisa had an impact. So as much as a lot of people pondered the Nathan Lyon omission, that basically all's well that ends well, and it's another success for the selectors. This Khawaja one's a fascinating flashpoint, because if you trace it back, and the selectors have there are a lot of people on scholarship that basically are big defenders of them at every turn, and they'll often cite things like, you know, head getting dropped in Nagpur, for example, and you kind of think, well, ultimately, I think they acknowledge that probably wasn't the right decision. They didn't pull the right rein there. The odd white ball game, sure, you can chuck in, you know, Nathan Lyon missing out in Brisbane and Jamaica in pink ball games where, you know, conditions don't necessarily suit, but the Steve Waugh comments about, you know, trying to move on players, and what he was basically referring to when he was saying, you know, the hard call on guys, that this is something this group's struggled with. He was clearly referring to, you know, Finch in the white ball version and Warner in the test version when the end had come and their performances were starting, you know, to trend down and to the right. Is it time to basically, you know, get them out of the team and how they handle that? And now they're in the same situation with Khawaja at this particular point of his career. So I know there was a lot of talk about, oh, well, what about all the fast bowlers? Should we drop them? Well, no, because their performances haven't tailed off at this stage of their career. And yet that this feels like the next major moment in that sequence. As much as you can cite all these other things, these are more apples with apples, aren't they, in the way you line up what happened with those other two openers, and the same thing that's happening here with Uzi.
Yeah, I'm going to be short here because we keep coming back to the same thing. This is actually a really easy decision. I think from the outside in, and maybe it feels hard, or maybe it's hard emotionally for them to do what is best for the team. But it's so clear. There's just it's black and white in my mind as to what that should be. So I don't see it as a hard decision. Sad. It's incredibly, like, I don't want to feel unsympathetic to the cause. This is a really sad situation for Usman, who has been an incredible servant, 80 tests, 1600s, has been called upon, you know, in times of need, and has responded. So sad.
He's been a fine player. There's no doubt.
Yeah. No one's calling that into question. It's right now, in this moment, what does the team need? And it's sad that the answer isn't Usman Khawaja, but it's not the answer.
Yeah, and I'm sure, ask Ian Healy, or there's lots of other places in the history.
Fairy tales in sport. No, it's just not I know we all get hooked in on this, but they just don't exist. When things move as quickly as they do and performances are important as they do, there's just no fairy tales.
The pink ball test. So I feel like every time it comes around, and particularly this year, it was particularly topical, I think, because England were involved, so they don't have nearly as many of them as we do. So, and there was a big break between the tests, so everyone was looking for something to talk about and write about, and it felt like, again, another referendum on this. But maybe also because the 150th anniversary test is going to be a pink ball test, which is controversial in itself. We've only had 25 of them in the history of the game, and that's how these two teams will compete in that fixture in, what is it, March of 2027? So yep. Early, yeah, not end of next summer. But, I mean, it's whatever your trade-off, obviously, for the red ball, and it is a slightly different version of the game. It's a tremendous time slot for people to come at home, put the TV on, you know, to be able to follow along with a test match night after night. It is super fan friendly for people in the southeast of Australia where, you know, the majority of the population reside.
And I'll also give you the tip, having watched 2 days of it live, it's not just fan friendly at home. In Brisbane, it is very fan friendly for people who want to go to the ground because the sun goes down earlier, and I've been to day-night tests in Adelaide where you sit in the sun forever and you feel like you're about to melt into the seat, and then the yep. lights come on for, you know, and it's dusk for
5 minutes,
5 minutes yeah. at the end of the day. So I thought the Brisbane day-night test, I was worried about the conditions, storms and the wicket, held up sensationally. That was as good a spectacle in the ground as I've been to. And Brisbane, more broadly, has had a bit of a glow up, I think, as a city. So it was just a fun night out. And so I'd actually think about going to 2 day-night tests. Adelaide,
ooh.
Brisbane, Perth, you can keep in the time zone, and Sydney and Melbourne, I'd keep as the ooh. Events. So I think I saw 8 million people. I think Channel 7 put out ratings. 8 million people watched the test
wow.
free to air over the course of the test match. That's a big number, yeah. folks. And so ultimately, there's the fan experience, there's the commercial aspect, and let's move with the times. I thought it was excellent, and I like it in Adelaide as well. And so, hey, how about 2?
I don't know about that. I think Adelaide's in the great slot pre-Christmas. Have it as the day game. I think the night... We should always start in Perth, and we should start with a day-night test in Brisbane. I think this is the order. I think this is the way to go. And then the day games, make Adelaide the pre-Christmas test match, back to red ball there. So I'm only one, but I think if the pink ball test has to be somewhere, let's keep it in Brisbane. There's a proper night session, and it's something great about, you know, the climate up there and the humidity, being outside at night. Like it's a chance to enjoy a balmy evening. You never have to worry about getting, you might have to worry about the storms, but you don't have to worry about getting cold. There's yeah. really no dramas about that.
I'm glad you put that on the talk list. It's been going through my mind. I thought it was as fun a test match as I've been to in a long, yeah. long time. So congratulations yep. to Queensland Cricket and Cricket Australia for putting it on as well as they did.
And they're dealing with the worst digs out of any of the five cities. I mean, the stadium's clearly on its last legs. They're going to get a redevelopment or a new stadium at some point. But it was a whole lot of fun. It was great. Australia A, they had a huge win over the England Lions. So it's not going well for either the A-team or the B-team, which is technically the A-team. 166 and 295 for the England Lions. And then in between, the Aussies made 588, 8 down declared. It's been a long while. I know Uzi got one over in Gaul, but we don't get a whole lot of our batsmen make, you know, daddy hundreds these days. And Nathan McSweeney, 226, not out. So he went large with an opportunity to bat at AB Field against, you know, the next best of what England has to offer, and cashed in big time. So, hey, hats off to him.
Loved it. And he went about it how he wants to go about it. And this is like the exactly... what we were talking about earlier. He faced 380 balls, got 220, cashed in, knew pretty flat attack, very flat wicket. It's like, hey, fellas, watch this. I'm going to get my head down and make a exclamation case in point here. So awesome. Great. I don't think it really impacts his test selection in the very near term. I think we're kind of well stacked for the role that he would play in the team. But it's nice to see him back playing good cricket. You know, being dropped from the test team, it takes a while to get your head around that. And we used the train analogy last night. You look up, the trains are miles down the station. It takes a while yeah. to actually try and catch a cab back to town. So he's now back in town. So my point being, without dragging this out too long, he got 100 yeah. in the last Shield game. He's in good form, and he's clearly mentally in a really solid place. And so that's only a good thing for Australian cricket.
Are we that stacked in the position?
What, batting at 4?
Yeah.
Part of me thinks there's a guy called Steve Smith who does it.
Yeah. For how much longer? I mean, you're saying
I don't know. I said in the immediate term, which is now.
So, I would argue in the depth chart, you know, it's, you know, all of a sudden it's, yeah, Inglis is there at the moment, but if Inglis isn't there and Head remains up the top, which at the moment there's no reason to believe that that's going to change, why wouldn't he be contending with Inglis for a spot in the middle order?
I think he's slow to contend with Inglis in the middle order. He's an old fan, and there's nothing wrong with this. I'm just saying in terms of style of play and how different people fit in between Marnus, Smith, you then add McSweeney. I think he's just a like for one of those two. And, you know, when one of those falls away, then he comes roaring back into conversation.
I was about to say, the other thing that happens too is if Inglis and age of concussion subs and everything else, that if Inglis does get a prolonged run at it now, and I hope for his case he does, there needs to be a reserve batter in the squad, and all of a sudden you're in the mix, as we like to say. Joe Richardson's back too, got four for, so well done to him. And Fergus O'Neill, four for in the second.
I did see O'Neill. That was excellent. How would you be feeling if your name was Bo Webster?
You'd feel a little bit like the forgotten man, wouldn't you?
Well, like he's just out of the conversation.
Yeah.
What, 2 weeks ago, he was neck and neck for a position.
How often do we say this? Sometimes the worst place to be is around the team. That if you're around the team and not playing, that somehow you're almost wearing that invisibility cloak like that they have in Harry Potter, that somehow just no one sees you. The game's going on around you. There's guys scoring runs in A games and in Shield cricket. And fortunately, Bo is 2 metres tall, and it feels like you said, his name's not on anyone's lips at the moment.
And yeah, that's perfect. I can't even add to that. The other thing, you know, from the roundup, as it relates to the test team, the Mitch Marsh chatter that we had last week.
Man.
Given the runs that are going between McSweeney, constant, like take your pick of names that are hot in the runs at the moment. We're going to pluck Mitch Marsh having played one Shield game and scored no runs. Come on.
So the conundrum at the start, where clearly the idea is he's coming back to play Shield cricket, and you can sort of read between the lines here, and that he needs to bat sort of towards the top of the order, and that's where the thinking is. And yet WA have the most stable opening combination in Sheffield Shield cricket, so that's Whiteman and Bancroft. Whiteman gets 100. Mitch misses out in the first innings, which can happen. He comes in at 3, so they don't mess with the opening combination. Whiteman and Bancroft stay. Mitch bats at 3, misses out in the first dig. Second dig, gets a chance to go and face the new ball. They send a night watchman out. So the night watchman goes to close the day rather than Mitch facing the new ball. It's like, isn't that the whole point? That he goes up and faces the ball when it's hard and new? It's not to protect him from the new ball. The whole thing just sort of made me, sort of shake my head a little bit. I thought the whole idea was get him up there when the ball's new and hard and get him playing his shots, and yet he had to wait for the next day to bat. Just a bit bizarre.
What else? Nothing
to us. Well done to Blake McDonald. So he got a match-winning 100 for Victoria as they won at the MCG against WA. We got three results here. South Australia beat Tasmania by 10 wickets. This was the first game to finish inside 3 days. Good to see Jordan Buckingham back and amongst the wickets too. Got four for in each dig. Hundreds for Jake Lehman and for Liam Scott. Jake Lehman's a 100 maker, isn't he?
Oh, mate. The blade is hot. It cooled for about 10 seconds there, but he's back. So what's that, 5 in 8 games or something?
Yeah. And there's a certain other guy that got 100. His name is...
I don't remember.
Oh, Kagan. Sam Constance, our man. He got 100. He's back in town. New South Wales, big winners. That'll keep the Wolves at the door for a little while longer for New South Wales cricket as well, Teddy, with a big win over the Bulls.
It wasn't a big win. It was a ginormous win. Well, they won by 380 runs or something and gave them an absolute towel up. I mean, yeah, we'll start with that last game first. New South Wales, actually, I don't mind the name. As you read down the list, you actually see some pretty strong talent coming through the pipeline. Joel Davies made his debut. Jack Edwards in the runs. Hicks and Shaw can both play. Constance 100. So, these young players are now coming through, high talent. There'll be some variability in results, but actually the style of play they played in this game was pretty encouraging, I would have thought. What I loved about Sami Kane, I think we touched on day one, was, the wicket was pretty good. The bowling was okay at best, but he got his head down. There was no, hey, I'm going to run down the wicket to a spinner and hit one up in the air to mid-off for a well-compiled 45. This was him back getting hungry doing what he'd done for a long period of time growing up, which is score hundreds and scoring match-winning hundreds. So it's a good sign. He's, again, not back in the test conversation, but the fact that he is back with that glint in the eye of this is actually what matters, I thought was excellent.
He's also out of the conversation too of losing his place in the state team, where it's sort of feels like a slippery slope where all of a sudden if you get trending the same way without a big spike back the other way, all of a sudden that's in the conversation at the end of the summer. So
for sure. So to cover off the other two games, Victoria, my goodness, they're playing some cricket, aren't they? And that was without Callaway and Fergus O'Neill. I love that the best players were playing in that A game mid season and actually tailing up the English lines. And then the Tassie Saka game, Tassie again up and down, played pretty poorly. So the season is there for the taking. It looks like Victoria run away; they'll host the final. I know we're only six games in, but it's heating up for who they're going to play.
And then we can't wait for all that momentum to flow into the next round in February. Sometimes
it is what it is. We can't deny that.
On Friday, I'm sure there'll be some kind of paparazzi story about what the English boys are up to in Noosa, so we'll chat about that. We'll sort of see what the Aussies are doing. They're back in their home ports, so they've got time just to hang out and refresh. And then the Big Bash starts on Sunday, so we can preview that in our chat on Friday, Monday and Friday, and after every day's play, of course, the ABC Cricket Podcast throughout the Ashes series. And I've got listener questions, which I was planning to get to today, but we're tight for time. So Danny, David, Tim, Simon, I'll chuck them all to Teddy on Friday. Including Solomon wants to chat to you about that incredible game between the West Indies and New Zealand. So we'll put a little pin in
that
there.
Already. It was on today's talk track, but you're right. Given flight delays, we're squeezed. Yeah.
We are. But hopefully that satisfies you and keeps you well nourished, at least with your cricketing conversation for the rest of the week. Teddy, I'll chat to you on Friday.
No way, Corb.
Don't forget all your latest Ashes information as well through the ABC website, abc.net.au/sport. Check out the live blog during play and all your latest news and analysis, abc.net.au/sport. ABC Cricket Podcast, Monday and Fridays, and after every day's play.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.